Hello there, and thanks so much for supporting the Music Career Show. My aim with this podcast is to help as many people as I can turn their passion for music into a career that can support them and their family by speaking to people who have actually done it and finding out how they've done it. With this in mind, I have developed my music career roadmap. This is a fully comprehensive and detailed step-by-step guide of how you can go from dreaming about your ideal career to actually implementing and living that dream. It is yours to download for free and can be found in the description of this episode. If you would like any support at any stage of your music career, you can reach out to me via email at barry@oneladmusic.com. I wish you all the best of luck and I hope you enjoy this week's episode of the Music Career Show.
Welcome to the Music Career Show, telling you the stories of the world's best professional musicians.
Hello there and welcome to the Music Career Show. My name is Barry and every week I'll be speaking with incredible musicians from all over the world about how they've honed their craft and made a career out of doing what they love the most. If you're a new listener, then while you still have your device in your hand, please take a second to subscribe and tell your friends all about the Music Career Show. Hello and welcome to the One Lad Podcast. Today I have the two Daves from the Black Donnellys. They're an acoustic two-piece from Dublin who now live in Las Vegas working full-time as musicians. As well as pushing the boundaries of musicianship to well beyond breaking point with their mental antics, the two boys are individually gifted in their respected fields and together they form the benchmark for all other like-minded outfits. They have multiple Guinness World Records, including the world record for the longest guitar solo, which I cannot wait to get into because you're not going to believe how long it is when we do talk to them. They've got plenty of stuff that they've got coming up in the next year or two. Lads, say hello. How are things? We've got Dave Rooney and Dave Brown. How are you doing, boys?
How are you, Barry? How's it going? Thanks for having us on.
How are you?
It's an absolute pleasure. Absolute pleasure to have you on. So before we get started, this is going to be really awkward if I have to keep saying Dave 1, Dave 2. So who's Dave 1, who's Dave 2, or how do I address you?
I'm Dave Rooney and he's Dave Brown. So you can say
Brown or Rooney, whatever you like.
I can go Roots and you can go Browner.
Roots and Browner. Yeah. In Eden Derry, a Browner is someone that's an eye in you.
That sounds about right.
Don't be browning me. It's saying Eden Derry. Don't be browning me. And if you're a browner, you're just kind of, you know. Jeez, anyway,
it's unbelievable.
I wonder did it come from me?
And most of the guys put very well.
Surprise at home, guys. Like I've been browned. Yeah.
Well, actually,
there you go.
When we used to work in Temple Bar, and then. Some of the venues used to say, like, you know, if Dave used to book a lot of the venues there, you know, and he'd send in, if a band went in there that weren't supposed to, or if you're teaming up with somebody that you're taught you're teaming up with, and he'd send some bleeding clanger into play. But then you've been brownered.
Nothing worse. No, would that happen often? It would.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you'd get a call, someone get a better gig, or just to not fucking into it, you know what I mean? I'm not going to look.
Coming to a clanger near you.
Yeah. And I knew that was available on Saturday night was shit, you know?
It's always the way. It's always the way. There's a reason they're available on a Saturday night.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, I suppose this podcast is all about inspiring the kind of the next generation, or even sometimes the current generation of musicians by finding out how people like yourselves got your start. So how about Ronzer? Was it Roots?
Roots.
Come to you first. Where do your roots come from? What's the crack? See the way I done that? See that little segment? That.
Brilliant, man. Brilliant.
Yes. What's the crack? Biddy, biddy, bop.
Anyway,
so the music started for me at quite a young age as far as where I was aware of it, if you like. My mother and father are huge music fans. My father's a taxi driver and I used to always want to be in the car with them and stuff like that. And I just always remember through the 70s music being played all the time, ELO and various other band, Andrew Gold and Gallagher and Lyle and all these, you know, these songs that just seem to stay with me, you know. I'd be listening to music without even knowing that I'm listening to it. That's the kind of affliction that music has given me, you know. 100%. And when it comes to singing songs and stuff like that, like, you know, I seem to have this innate ability to be able to recall how the song goes. I may not have the words, but I know how the song is going. So it's kind of stuck to me in that respect. Through that, then my mother and father just buying albums and albums every week. Very, very broad kind of choice of music that they had and what they were into, and that went everywhere from Billy Joel right out to the Pointer Sisters, and right to Bob Marley and all this kind of stuff. So that was always a huge thing for me, and I was always singing along. There were big Beatles fans as well, so I was always singing along to the records and stuff like that. We had the Please Please Me album played to death in my house, you know. But moved on through that, and started singing in local bands and stuff like that. We were terrible, but anyway, we started.
That's start somewhere. Started.
Absolutely. And then it wasn't until I got to Munich, and then I started singing in karaoke shows and stuff like that. And then I used to busk for a while, and then ultimately moving to Denmark when I got a job in a bar in the Shamrock in Copenhagen, and it was a music bar, a live music bar, and that's pretty much where it started for me. And I left my job after about maybe a year and a half there, on my 26th birthday, and I've been a musician ever since. So it's been quite the journey, you know.
Fantastic. I love that. It always brings me back to stories like that. Always take it back to that song. What do they call it? The Irish pub song. No matter where you are in the world, if you're from Ireland and you can pull a pint or you can sing a song, you're sorted. You're absolutely sorted. Do you know what I mean? You'll never be stuck for work. So you started gigging professionally at 26.
At 26, yeah.
That was in Denmark.
Copenhagen, Denmark. And I immediately I was set on, what do you call that? When you go Finland, circuit. Norway, Sweden. A circuit, thanks, Dave. We played Finland, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and Germany, and Austria as well. And it was a great way to start, because you were absolutely microwaved into the business, like, you know. And at the time, I could only play slow songs, you know what I mean? So I started off actually playing bass with a guy, a fella called Eamon Mitchell, and he was playing guitar. And then we did that for about a year, and then he horsed off. I don't know, he went somewhere anyway. So I had to start playing guitar. And as I started playing guitar, I could only play slow songs, so the gig wasn't great, you know. But I could sing, like, you know, so that's what was my saving grace, you know. And and it just went on from there. I went on to Spain, played the resorts down there for 10 years, came back to Ireland, did a lot of stuff with Dave there and George Murphy and various other bands, and jumped in and out as bass player of bands, and started them writing songs and released a solo album, and then ultimately started playing in America, came to Las Vegas, and the rest is history, you know. The
rest is history. Very good. Yeah. So you're saying there that you kind of had to learn how to play guitar. So were you very late in learning how to play guitar?
I was. I didn't start playing guitar until I was 24.
Right.
I was, no, this is as true as God. No, I tried it like when I was 17, and I tried when I was 19. I picked it up and I went, I can't play that thing, right? So you know the way you get so frustrated with it now, because I thought it just wasn't for me. And then it wasn't until I went to Copenhagen in Denmark, and I was in the, you know, I was around a lot of musicians, and I said, I need to get a guitar. She said, get a guitar and we'll show you how to play and all that. So I went and bought this Hondo for $30 or 30
great guitar.
Great stuff.
Now the action was about that height, right?
They should be
about three inches high, right? And they used to call me Hatcha Hands.
I can imagine.
I'd be bursting the bleeding Hondo, you know. But that was the first start for me. I used to jump into the sessions on a Tuesday night for no pay. You'd have free beer. And thanks very much to the likes of Desi Higgins and that over there in Copenhagen, who really gave me my start, really.
You know? Very good. And then what was so that was obviously the difference in when you were a young fella trying to sort of teach yourself, and then having someone there sort of to bounce off of, and like not even maybe like show you, but like keep you right more than anything else. Or did you get lessons from them or what?
No, I never got lessons. I just sat down and I talk about Desi Higgins a lot, because he was a huge inspiration for me. Because when I said to him, Desi, do you think I can do this? And he looked at me and he says, Dave, the music is in you. He says, it's in you. So you're going to be great. He goes, you're going to be absolutely great. He always used to say that. So he was great at that kind of, you know, pushing you along. And look, you know, whether I'm great or whether I'm not, the point of it is that I got out there and I was able to do it. and to be able to write the songs and be able to play different instruments and stuff like that. So I owe that to him, definitely, without a doubt.
Fantastic stuff. Yeah, no, one of the singers in one of my bands from when I was like 16, 17, we actually went and toured America. We'd done we'd done 2 weeks in Washington, D.C. Kev, he never played guitar, and he's the same age as me, so he's 29, and he's only just now learning how to play guitar, and he does stick stuff up on Instagram. And same as yourself, Dev, he tried a couple of times, and I tried to show him things, and he just kind of was like, I'm happy enough singing, and that was it. But now he's actually digging in, he's getting it done, so whatever the click in the mindset is, he's now flying it. So it just shows you that it's never too late to start. What about yourself there, Browner, then? How did you get on? How did you start off?
I was in a homeless shelter.
And someone left this battered old Hondo in the corner.
Battered old fella there beside me. No, I was growing up in the flats. My brother was he was an apprentice welder, so he got a job which was very unusual from where I come from. And he used to bring home records, and he brought his Deep Purple and Rainbow and Led Zeppelin and all that. And then I heard Tin Lizzy, and that was it. I heard Gary Moore, heard Tin Lizzy Live and Dangerous then with Brian Robertson. And that was it. I just like, this is, I can't believe someone can make this noise. And I got really sick when I was a kid, when I was about 10. I got this mad fever that I had to stay in bed for about like 4 or 5 months. He bought me a guitar a year earlier. I never touched it. Then I was sitting in the bed, nothing else to do. So I taught myself to play. So I just played along to Tin Lizzy songs, all wrong, obviously, but just to get them. And a friend of mine then drew me, because we hadn't a penny to buy books or anything. He drew me all the chords on a A4 sheet of paper. So I just learned from that. So I started learning all the all that sort of stuff. And I loved Tin Lizzy. And then my brother brought me to see them. So I seen Tin Lizzy 1 week, and 2 weeks later I seen AC/DC. And I remember, I always say the first band I seen live was Tin Lizzy. It actually wasn't. It was Sweet Savage, where the guy from Led Zeppelin, or the guy from Def Leppard, what's his name, Vivian Campbell. They opened up for Tin Lizzy. And he was an amazing
guitar player. He's Irish, isn't he? He's from the North,
yeah,
I think, isn't he?
I remember the noise of the guitar just live. The thing that got me first was the noise of the amps before the band came on stage, when you could hear them, that rumble, and you knew there's something going to happen. And then when they hit I was done. I said, I want to do that. I don't want to do anything else in the whole world except be on that stage with them. So that was it. And then I got into it. We used to jam around the flats with the bands, and it's all original stuff. The first, try to learn first, obviously, you're learning. Learn all the punk stuff first, you know what I mean? Because that was the easier, the four chords.
Three chords, four chords, power chords, easy peasy.
From the Clash to the Sex Pistols, and then the Undertones. We heard the Undertones. I was there listening to it when Teenage Kicks came out, and your man played it twice. Remember all that? So that noise of a guitar really was my thing. I just loved it. Then start getting in. My brother was in a band, and then I got into his band, and then I start trying to write original music, and that's what I did. I never played a cover song till I was like 28 or 29.
Oh,
it was always originals. Yeah, it was always original bands, like all the way up. And then I had a 9-piece band. My first band was China Doll years ago with my brother and their mates, and all. We were supposed to get signed. That didn't happen. So we were gigging the same time as, like, there was us, Something Happens, Aslan, all that, the Blades, all them bands coming up, you know. I was younger than everybody, so but I loved going to see them. I loved to go and see the original stuff and all that, like. So that was it. Got into that. Then I had a 9-piece band called Away It Is. We had a top 20 hit and a top 30 hit, and I actually wrote the two of them along with the other guys in it. And then had a band, moved on to a band called Little Sister Sage there, and we won their Hot Press Bacardi Unplugged, and toured all around Europe in the same circuit that Dave did. Believe it or not, we were actually either a step behind them or a step ahead of them on the circuit.
That's right. And did you two know each other, or that was just...
No, not then. Crazy,
imagine that, right? That's mad.
Yeah, done all the circuit from all around, from Finland, Sweden, the whole lot. And then up to then came back home, and worked then with that band, obviously just fizzles out, and then start working with Terry Woods from the Pogues. Did his his album, the music from the Four Corners of Hell, done that with him, put all that together, put the band together, and that's where the first version of the Black Donnellys came along. Went from that then into doing working with we've done some stuff with Ronnie Drew, then done and then at the end of that I was working, I got called then to work with George Murphy. So I needed to put a band together for George.
So that, that would have been after he was on
Eurostar.
Eurostar, that's right. Yeah,
so
I remember.
We did the Dream the Dream tour, and I was like MD on that, and I put together for him, and we got the album at number one, the quickest number one in Ireland, I think, ever. So we did that, and then we needed new songs for the next album, and I was on holidays in Lanzarote, and Dave was up on stage with another guy. And we got talking, and he said, I write songs. And I said, what have you got? And he actually sent, the first song he sent me was This Is My Home, and two of those. So we recorded that, and we brought it to Sony and a few other people. And we had it there, but then everything went, the record company didn't want to do it, and it just fizzled out then, the whole lot. So then finished up, and I said, like, I did the, then went in, and I used to have a studio in Ashtown, and everyone rehearsed there with everyone from like some picture house were there, Aslan were there, Blink, the Marbles, all sorts of bands were there. And then the sort of recession hit, and I was then doing all the gigs in Temple Bar, and they're all doing all the stuff for everybody, and I started to pick up to play mandolin then at that stage. And because I always loved the Irish stuff, they're really good. Like, you know, I loved what Horse Lips were doing. I loved Moving Hearts were doing. I loved them, the Chieftains, all that stuff. You know, some of the stuff the Hottest Flowers would do when they would jam was outstanding. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I loved that stuff. So we're trying to incorporate all that in what we were doing. And then I did the world record then, the first world record, which was I played for 114 hours straight in Temple Bar with all the musicians from Temple Bar. Everyone jumped in. It was brilliant.
And so that guitar solo, 114 hours. So that wasn't just you then, was it? Or how in the name of God?
It was marathon guitar playing. It was I played for 114 hours, but everybody joined in. Like Dave came in and did a set. Like Lad Lane Boys did a set. I had Nick Kelly in, some of the boys from the Commitments, like Dave Brown from Picture House, loads of people like that would come in. All the musicians from Temple Bar as well joined in and all jammed with me. So it was brilliant. It was like my festival for 5 days. You know, it was great to do.
And what was the criteria of playing? Did you just come up and noodle away for an hour, or did you have to play
songs? You had to entertain as well. It's like all the other ones we did. No, we played songs. I played 1,372 different pieces of music.
Unreal.
Yeah.
Unreal. That's amazing. And was it like 24 hours, I'd imagine, surely?
Yeah, straight through, all the way through. Yeah, and it was just like, you'd have someone would come, opened up with, like some of the lads, I'd Claire Pilo singing with me. So I did like said, Fleetwood Mac songs and Son of a Preacher Man and all that. So she'd go off then too, because you can't repeat the same song within 4 hours. So the way I had it structured then, that band would go off, and then I had Lad Lane, who are a complete trad band. So I played trad with them for 2 hours. So that's your 4 hours done. Yeah. Then I'd bring up someone like, say, Roy Buckley. He'd do a set. And then Dave would come on and do his sort of set, which would be, they're all different sets. No one would repeat any songs, you know?
Yeah.
So, but I played on every one of them.
Jesus, your hands must have been falling off.
Up to the last, on the 110th, 8th hour, 9th hour, I was actually with Dave Brown, Picture House. He goes, you okay? And I said, my hands are so sore. And I had a point of ice. So you got 25 seconds in between songs. So I put my hand in the ice for 22 seconds, take them out, rub them, get, and start again. But then the adrenaline kicked in when it was coming towards the end, and I had no pain at all. I wasn't tired. I had no pain, nothing. It was just this. I couldn't believe I was going to do it, you know?
And had you been up awake for 4 days at this stage?
Yeah, 5 days. Yeah.
And 5 days? Jesus, 5 days.
And because before that, you have to train for it. I was training with a guy called Carl Henry. And the week before, we were playing a gig down in... we were down in Killarney, David, you remember that? And we done the gig, and I stayed up for 72 hours to see could my body take it. And the only reason I went to bed, I was bored because everyone else was hammered. You know, I mean, I wasn't drinking. So the rest of them were all lying around the fucking hotel room in a heap, you know. And I was like, I've gone to bed, man. Just bored. Like, I went through all the stories from being sober all the way to people being rubber, you know, yourself. Yeah. Passing out, pissing in the corner, you know, having the row, then crying, and then and then passed out, and I'm like, oh my god, I'm still awake here, you know. So
Jesus, that's unreal. That's absolutely amazing.
You do something like that, they will tell you. You have a monster team around you. You know what I mean? Loads of people around you to do it. You know.
Yeah.
So then, but doing that, then that's the people who owned Rerod in Vegas see me and they asked us to come over, and as they say, the rest is history. We came over and did it and came back and forward for a couple of years, and then now we're here.
And now yous are here. That's amazing. Yeah. That's absolutely that is absolutely outrageous. That's one of the most mental stories I've ever heard. As soon as you say like 5 days of guitar playing, I can't go through like an hour and a half of a gig without snapping strings. Again, a disaster. I go through. Dave, you were saying Dave Rooney, you were saying about people calling you hatchet hand. The boys in, when I was in Salute, they used to say that I played with a sledgehammer, because I remember one night I broke 7 strings on a brand new set. So I broke every single string on the guitar at some point. I broke the same one twice. More than likely the G, to be fair. But I remember breaking 7, and that was I think it was the first time I'd ever broke the A and the low E. Ever, never mind in the one gig, but I broke every last fucking one of them. And I tell you, it was my claim to fame. So I was, that I broke.
Here's
7
a couple of, here's a point, just a point for you. Obviously, the sadly with sharp or whatever, that'll cut the strings on you, and then as well, you know, or up at the note if it's sharp or whatever. But we play loud, but we have our guitars turned up loud, so you don't actually have to hit it as hard. Now, playing gigs at home, let's say traditionally. When you're running around in a pickup band, as we'll call it, in the words of Phil Kilder. But you always had two tops, you know what I mean? And you very rarely had monitors, because it'd be too much of a hullabaloo pulling in monitors and all the rest of it. So what I used to do is I used to turn the speakers inwards, like so, you know what I mean? So you'd get a little bit of a... That was essentially the monitor. But but now when we have monitors, we've got big 2,000-watt monitors, and they're great. If you have it nice and loud in front of you, well then you're not actually hitting the guitar as hard. And as a result, and it's good for your technique as well, because you start to like build a style and how to dig in and get in under the strings for various like, you know, when you want to kind of impress a certain amount or whatever, if you're doing a bit of lead or whatever you're doing. And I found through that I was able to, like, the strings would last much, much longer. So just going forward might be something for you.
I've done all of it. I've done exactly what you do. Turn the speakers in. I bring monitors with me. I've got in-ear monitors that I use sometimes. I've spent yonks researching the best saddles. I've modified one of my electric, I've modified 2-3 of my electric guitars that they have like the Les Paul style bridge, so that they now have roller bridges. I even modified a semi-hollow guitar so that it has a roller bridge with a piezo pickup underneath it, so that I can play that, because getting a roller bridge on an acoustic guitar is a nightmare. I've looked into it so much, and I don't know what it is. Strings just do not like me, and that's that's just it.
When we played electric, I played Gretsch guitars, right? And I've got a few of them, and I get them done by Derek Nelson, who does all U2's guitars, you know, and they use Gretsch. And I brought Brian sets of Gretsch, and I bought a White Falcon. And the first thing he said to me was, do you want me to fix them for you? That was his first words. Because they have
$4,000 of a guitar, and you want me to fix it for you?
Yeah, because they have the movable bridge, which is a fucking stupid idea. And the way I play as well, like yourself, and like that, too hard. The thing would be sliding out with chewing all the way through. So he just said that. So he just pinned them down, and they're brilliant. Do you know what I mean?
Good stuff. Nice. Excellent stuff. So what's your... we'll go back to Dave Rooney there. What's your we're talking about instruments. What's your favorite instrument? What's your go-to? The one that you have. What's your favorite instrument that you have?
We're talking acoustic guitars now, right?
Acoustic guitars, mandolins, flutes, didgeridoos.
Yeah.
I play bass. I love bass, and I don't get much chance to play. Like I used to play it a lot more. You know, when I was down in Lanzarote, I was in Charlie's band in Charlie's Bar, and I was the bass player in that. And that was great because it was 3 years of just, excuse me, banging away, just playing bass, and it was cool. And I was in a great band, and I had some great drummers, and it's amazing. You can't, I mean, to play bass with great drummers, I don't think there's nothing else better than that for me. Because I generally sing when I'm playing bass as well. And mm-hmm. when you've got like a really good drummer that you lock into it, there's various styles. Some drummers, like when you're linking up with them, they play on the beat. Some play behind the beat. Some are even ahead of the beat, you know. Mm-hmm. But I like on the beat. I like right on. And that kind of brings out my playing as a player and in singing as well. So I love that. And I had the Ernie Ball. I had the... I'm after getting a new one, a cheaper one, a copy, a model Array 34, and the thing is alive. I got it for like $350.
That's sterling, case. Is it?
Is it sterling? You know what? It's not even. Is it made by sterling? It may be made by sterling. I should know this, shouldn't I? I have it there right beside me, actually.
As long as you can play the thing, sure, it doesn't matter what it looks like or what it's called, surely.
Well, the funny thing is, I had the original one as well, the Stingray and the Ernie Ball Stingray, and it was great. The black one was fantastic. But this one's better, you know, it's just a better guitar, and it's alive. So, in answer to your question, I love bass, but now that I play acoustics more, we play Martin, so I have a HD28 Martin, which I think is the best acoustic guitar out there. I'm currently waiting on a Maiden. The Tommy Emmanuel Maiden, the cutaway, and they're meant to be alive. You know what I mean? So I haven't tried one, but I'm looking forward to having a bash at one of them and seeing how we get on.
They're Australian, aren't they?
They are. Yeah, they are. There's a couple of prominent Irish guitarists that are using them at the moment, and I've seen various other like prominent pop stars using them and country stars using them. Keith Urban uses them as well. And the chap out of Men at Work, Colin Hay, he's using them as well. They're obviously all I'm hearing is good things, we'll know next month anyway.
Now that you mention that, I do notice that an awful lot that there are these, because I remember when I don't know if they first came out 10 years ago. I'm sure they've been on the go for far longer than me. But when I started noticing them, they were like your Tommy Emmanuels, the really kind of higher end, kind of virtuoso boys were playing them. And it just seemed to be them that knew about them. And it was this like kind of exclusive club. But you're right, it does seem to be more and more people are playing them. And they sort of seem to be replacing that whole like Taylor crowd. So like you say, the Martins, fantastic. Do you know what I mean? They're the industry standard. That's the benchmark. If you can be as good as a Martin or sound as anywhere close to a Martin, you're doing all right. But everyone then seemed to be kind of, the Taylor ones seemed to be like sort of in vogue, and they were almost like the trendy ones. Whereas now the Maitens seem to be sort of slipping into where the Taylors are now sort of drifting off a bit. An interesting one.
It may suit the way that we play. We're kind of fairly... we're fairly boisterous in our volume and our approach, and we do a lot of like fast instrumentals like that Dave plays and stuff like that, and basically chasing them, and then and then we're playing lead and playing, you know, I like to play rhythm and bass lines and all that kind of stuff when I'm playing, and I'm getting more into lead now, but these kind of guitars are great because they're actually built for the musician, meaning that the bracing is much stronger. They're a much stronger guitar. They won't wilt to humidity as much as the Martin would, let's say, you know. And Martins are absolutely beautiful. And we're playing Road Series, Performer Series Martins as well. I've three Martins here. I've Dreadnought, a HC28, and then the Road Series. And the Road Series are just like they're alive. Like, I mean, they really are very good, and they suit exactly what we're doing. And I think the Maiden has just pipped them now with this because it's built in that way, and it has the AP5 Pro pickup in it as well, which has a great feedback booster in it as well as a natural. And you have the piezo in the saddle and in the neck as well. and then you have the microphone in there as well. So the guitar is absolutely active and alive. Yeah. So every little nuance and every little, you know, slide and glick that you're going to hear, you're going to pick up on. So
yeah,
I'm looking forward to it. I think it'll bring on the playing as well. I think it'll bring it on, you know.
It definitely will, because especially with the microphone, there'll be nowhere to hide. There'll be absolutely nowhere to hide at all with any sort of, like you say, it'll pick it up. It'll pick it up where a piezo might notice the little things that you mess up on. The microphone will absolutely find out absolutely anybody at all. I've played acoustic guitars that have mics in it, and it terrified the life out of me, because you know yourself, you kind of present as well as you can, but at the end of the day, it's only four chords, and
you're in your nude when you're playing acoustic guitar.
Absolutely.
It's very honest, and I like that kind of what people coined the phrase, three chords and the truth. Like, you know, if you're sitting there, you're singing and you're playing, well, it's just totally you making that sound come out of the guitar and making, you know what I mean? So it's a very humble in one way, but it's also very it's very truthful in another. Like, it really is. It brings out exactly what you're doing. So you're dead right what you're saying there.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that. That I play in a two piece, the same as used by is the exact same setup. I play guitar and mandolin, and I've got a bandmate, and he does most of the singing. I do a few of the harmonies, and he plays acoustic guitar. And I very recently got into playing electric mandolin. And ever since I've started playing electric mandolin, I was like, Jesus, I'm unreal. As opposed to the acoustic mandolin, because as you say, when you're playing an acoustic instrument, there's nowhere to hide at all. You're playing completely and utterly in the nude. And the electric mandolin, it probably shouldn't be saying this now, all the places that I play. But anyway, sure, look at it's amazing how much you can hide and how much you can get away with.
You still have to be able to play it, though.
Of course you do. I wanted to come back to something that you said, Dave Brown, about playing mandolin, actually, because that was a particular point of interest for me. Whoever's like listening to this, so when I originally got in touch with the boys, I got in touch with Dave Brown, because when I started playing mandolin, he was actually the one that I kind of looked up to and based my style on, believe it or not. I mean that, Dave, I genuinely do, because when I started, I just... Like, I play mandolin like a guitar. I play everything like a guitar. I went for fiddle lessons, and the fiddle teacher told me, he's like, you play fiddle like you play a guitar. And I don't even know how that's possible, but apparently I do. And I quickly realized that playing mandolin is not just the same as playing... Like, of course, there's transferable skills. If you can play one, you can make an eyes on the other, of course.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's not the exact same instrument. So I had to sort of figure that out. And I loved the way that you play, because you seem to bridge the gap between the guitar player that can and the mandolin player. How did you get into playing mandolins? Because you were quite late to that, weren't you?
Yeah, I wasn't that long ago. I remember playing. I was in a band with Terry Woods, who's an amazing mandolin player, and it was watching. Was listening to him and watching him. I never just watched him play stuff. And it was a certain, me and him used to sit down and play, and he when he played the mandolin or he played the sitarin, he'd fill up the whole room on his own without any other. And I was thinking, how the fuck is he doing that? You know what I mean? And it was that way of playing where you'd play some of the melody and some of the chord, but your timing has to be really good. So yeah. And that was it. And then sometimes you can break it, which is, you know, you just follow the melody on its own. And then even if I'm jamming with other, especially with fiddle players, I'll say to them, you keep the melody, I go, and then I'll go off a bit on it, just bringing back into the Tin Lizzy stuff and bringing the guitar into it. But it's that full sound where you've got both the rhythm and it always has to ring, especially if you're in a two-piece, because you need to fill up the room as well, you know?
Of course.
That's what it was. And quick story for you, we were playing in the Napa Valley Film Festival, and... We were on stage, and 4 feet, 5 feet away was Kevin Bacon. He was the guest of honor there. And how much was the plate, Dave? What's the dinner?
$5,000.
5 grand a plate. For the dinner.
5 grand a plate. Well, it's all like film stars. You know what I mean? And
we didn't get a plate. We got sandwiches out the back from Subway or something. You know what I mean?
What in the name of God are you getting for dinner for 5 grand?
I don't know. Well, somebody else.
It was more of a thing. It was an association thing, and I think they were donating to it and all that kind of thing. And they were raising money.
Fair enough.
Some fella that was painting stuff with his feet or something like that. There's something like that going on.
It was mad. And then we played. So we did This Is My Home, and then we did one of the tunes and it flew. So that was great. And we were, of being Black Donnellys, we were running off because our movie was being shown somewhere else and we were doing a question and answers. And I was packing the gear away, and I got a tip on my shoulder. I looked around, it was Kevin Bacon. And he gave me a big hug, and he said, "That was fantastic." I actually called him from the stage. I said, you're from Philly, so you're Irish. And he says, yeah, somewhere in this, your third generation, you're 3 generations back, your name. And we had a bit of a goof with that. Came up anyway, and he said to me, "I'm doing a movie about a mandolin player." He says, "How do I do what you're doing?" And I said, Yeah, he said, how do I make, so I just told him the same thing, the open it up, keep your fingers open, and when you're hitting it, just on and off the string. I had a little bit of thing with him, and I said, and if you do that, it'll make you look like you're playing faster as well for the cameras, you know. So we had a good goof about that, but he was the same. He said, "How do you do that? Because I'm a guitar player, can I do it?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "If you're doing the stuff, use open as much as you can. And if you're using the capo, make sure it's in the key that you can use the open strings as well." So just same thing as you were saying. That's what bridged the gap for me anyway, you know?
Amazing. That's absolutely amazing. That's, Jesus, I feel a little bit starstruck about that. That's madness. Kevin Bacon.
Well, the starstruck as we were, I can tell you.
Yeah. If this ever, like, if the podcast ever goes anywhere and I give the episodes like individual names, I'm going to call this one Mandolin Lessons with Kevin Bacon. That's unreal, like. Jesus. You touched on the movie there, Dave. Why don't you tell us all about the movie? I loved it, by the way. I absolutely loved it. I remember it came out here. Just as lockdown hit, and it was the one thing that I actually spent money on, was because I knew, honest to God, because when lockdown hit here, I don't know what it was like over with Jews boys in America, because I know kind of some different states were doing their own different things, but when the lockdown hit here, everything stopped, absolutely everything, the whole kit and caboodle. We had the queue outside Tesco for miles to get in to do the shopping for months on end, but all of my income pretty much stopped, because I was the one and only thing that was ever consistent in my life was music, and I'd had jobs here, there and everywhere, and I had literally it's the usual story, you know yourselves. But in February of that year, I'd left a job working in a play school. That's a nursery for anyone that's not from Ireland, working with 2 and 3 year olds. And I finally left the job and took on a job working as a guitar teacher. 2 weeks later, the whole thing shut down. The whole place shut down. And I remember, because I'd been buzzing about your film, because I'd seen the... I'd seen the promo, and obviously because I had gigged in some of the same places that used by as a gig, I had a bit of a connection to it. And when lockdown hit, that was the one thing I was like, right, I'm definitely putting aside £12.99 to make sure that I can buy the boys' film on Amazon. I swear to God. So how did that come about?
So let me see now. So I've got this neighbour across the street from me here. Her name is June, and she's she's been my guardian angel, the family's guardian angel since we came here.
All right.
And we were talking about this madman here, Browner. He was talking to somebody on the stage. I think this is where it all started. And he was saying, he was talking to this couple, and they said, like, oh, yeah, my son is doing, like, the 50 states. You know what I mean? He's driving around doing the 50 states. And Browner goes, is that a thing? Like, you know, is that a thing what they're doing? And him being him, look at that. And he runs into the kitchen, into the back office where the computer is. And he looks to see if there's a world record for 50, you know, playing the 50 gigs. And it turns out that George Thorogood did 50 states, 50 shows in 50 states in 50 days. And of
that
course,
bad to the bone, that fella.
Yeah, that's the guy. That's bad to the bone, yeah. Aye. So that was him. And then he goes out and he goes, listen, I have a great idea. And I just looked at him and I went, get away from me, because I know I know what's coming next, you know. She said, listen, we should try and do this. You know, we should try and, you know, the world record. Let's do 60 gigs in 50 stays in 40 days, you know. And I'm looking at him kind of going, like, I'm just, no. You know, because we've done the other one, don't forget. We did the other one, 372 hours, the longest concert ever held. We did that in 2014. And we broke that world record.
I think that was when I was still sort of half on the scene, and that was on the go. I actually think he had one of the boys from Eden Derry. There was one of the lads that worked.
It's his brother. Fitzy's brother.
Yeah.
Dara. He was great. Yeah,
Dara Fitz. I know him really, really well. Used to do.
I was asking for him. Definitely. The next time I see him. Great lad.
He was in a band called Frantic Jack, and his father was the principal of the boys' school when I was there. So he's a bit of a local celebrity. But
you'd never think Fitzy's father was the principal of a high school, would you?
You absolutely would not. Mother of God, I used to.
He's bonkers. He is.
I used to come across
the remote control to hold on to. Do you know what I mean?
No, Jesus. I used to come across him on Saturday nights when I was just coming up and learning how to gig, and I'm like, does your father know that you're up to all of this? He's like, what does Fitzy think of this? And that was me, 17, 18, thinking that of him, 25, 26. What would your father say to that now? But anyway, sorry, Dave, I completely interrupted you there with a tale.
Listen, we need glory for the story. But anyway, okay, next thing we know, we're going about it, and Re-Rab are going to help us, and they got all behind us and all the rest of it. And then we kind of felt that we were making new contacts here in Las Vegas, and there was a management company here who looked after a lot of the headliners and stuff like that. And me and Dave were talking, and we kind of went like, you know what, we're going to need help with executing this, because it's a fairly big thing, you know. Now, we could have done it ourselves, and probably, you know, should have, you know, hindsight's 2020, you know. But anyway, it was suggested that my neighbor knew this chap that ran. That worked down there, you know. So we linked up with him, and then we went down, we had the meetings and all the rest of it, and we were putting this whole thing together, how we were going to do it. And of course, like all projects, it was all big and shiny, and it was going to be great and all the rest of it, and it all whittled down to about that size, right? And they tripped up themselves, because they went and they got in contact with the Guinness Book of Records, and they set out the parameters, but they set them out wrongly. And they said 60 venues as opposed to 60 performances. The difference between venues is that you have to go and get insurance, and you have to sell tickets and all this kind of carry on. We wanted to play 60 performances in off the beaten track kind of places. And we wanted to go to all the great towns and all that, and down to Texas and down to New Orleans and Nashville and all these places. And in fairness, we got to most of them, but a lot of them we did actually miss, you know, just because this company kind of took over the operations of this, and then they helped set out the route that we were going to go and stuff like that, and it just became like an absolute pile of shit, like, because as much as the intention was there to make it happen, it just didn't go to the way it was, and there was a lot of background stuff that was going on that wasn't good, you know, and we were very kind of we had to go kind of street on the whole thing. And we had to kind of get ourselves, but we finished ourselves in the end. But it was very, very, very hard to do. Anyway,
with the camera crew.
Yeah, with the camera crew and all the rest. So to get the movie, I was put in touch. They'd linked up with a guy called Carl Nickley, who had just moved here from Los Angeles, and he'd gone to film school and all the rest of it, and he was, you know, getting into filming. And he linked up with a couple of Emmy Award-winning directors of photography. So we had a marvelous team. So Dave was at home at this stage. He went home for a couple of weeks. So I went to meet this chap anyway, and I had breakfast with him and went through all the stuff and all the rest of it. And we got on very well, and he liked the idea of what we were doing, who we were and all the rest of it. And it started to form all of that. And while that was going on, simultaneously, I was linked with the Folktale Winery, which we had started playing up there. And they loved us, you know what I mean? They loved us, like, up there. And we used to sell it out, 250 seats. So the owner of that, we went to him. Me and Dave met him and had lunch here. And we went and we kind of pitched the idea to him. And he sponsored it. So fair play to him. That was Greg Ann of Folktale Winery. So that's how it all came together. And It was a start. it was a start, but it didn't end the way it started. And it was nothing like the idea that we planned.
And it was, but it is where it went to, and it's been great. And it was every day was literally 24 hours long. There was no the feed itself is hard enough to do, but the shit that was going on in the background incredible. Yeah. You know,
it was tough, and people shouting for court cases and want me money for this, and me money for that. We were kind of going, what? So there was a guy involved that was kind of telling people that he was going to give them this, that, and the other, and if they put money in, he'd give it back out, and he wasn't doing that at all. But they were trying to put the blame on all of us, and it was terrible. And people weren't getting paid, and it was just badly, very, very badly run. You know, in the end, our friends came in to help us. Anybody that we knew. We had a GoFundMe and all the rest of it, and we actually got over it just by the skin of our teeth.
I also browned a few people because I booked a load of gigs and got paid for it and still haven't done them yet.
I didn't book any gigs.
I booked three and I was like, give us the money, we'll get it, and then I'd blame everything on COVID that we couldn't do the gig, you know.
Well, sure, look, you have to do what you have to do, but I saw a couple of times, I'm sure it was literally just scraping like the top of the iceberg, but like I remember there was someone in the film going around, we're not entirely sure if this needs to be on the disclosure, but we're going to go and give you the disclosure anyway, do you want to be on film? And they were taking like notes of like how many people were in attendance and all these other different criteria. So you didn't end up with the record in the end then, did you not?
No, not yet.
So is that still a bit of a, is it still on the cards or what's the crack?
I don't think it's going to happen, to be honest with you, because of the way that when we went and we presented our case to them, they were saying no. But then we asked the question, why did you let it go ahead when you knew that the parameters were wrong? So then we put it to them that, give us the record for what we did. Because we did the 60 performances. In fact, we did 67. But
67?
We did 67. Yeah, that's what we did. And the guy that we were in connection with and all the rest of it, he just wasn't helpful. You know, simple as that. And there's no two ways to say that, you know. But so as a result of all of this, it actually worked better for the story. And at the end of the movie, because we've been in loads of theaters where it's being played, and they still haven't recognized the record, and the whole cinema goes, ooh, like this, you know. So I think by not getting it has given added more value to the story, I think, you know.
It's the underdog story, isn't it? Like, do you know what
that's
I mean?
That's exactly
the,
what it is.
The two exactly boys being bet down by the man.
But listen, it's been great.
As I said, I think it represented every independent musician, you know, out there. People just see it as a musician. You go on, and it's like when someone says to you, "No, do a gig." Or you only played for 2 hours. You're like, "Yeah, but I'm an hour coming here, and an hour setting up, going home." Do you know what I mean? There's no gig is only 2 hours. You know what I mean? It's like, so everyone was like, "This is what we show is what actual." It's not like fucking America's Got Talent. It's not like The Voice. It's not like you've got this massive production. It's just you going in with your amps, you're setting up. And then this is where it goes back to being able to play and be good, that you can do it anywhere. Do you know what I mean? We played acoustically. Yeah. We played in McSorley's in New York. And there's only one other band that has ever played McSorley's. And that's the Clancy Brothers. We're the only band to do that. And we did it with two little Fishman amps.
Fishman amps, the loud box.
You see, That's nearly better. That's nearly better than it's just as good as any official record. Having any official record that use are in the same sentence as the Clancy Brothers. Not many people can say that. Do you know what I mean? Not many people can say that. So then you said 67. So what was the final score then? 67 gigs in all 50 states.
In all 50 states in 35 days. 35 days, actually.
35 days. Yeah. Jesus Christ.
To get to the end of it was, it was heavenly. It was the feeling of the accomplishment was unbelievable. I mean, we've been through a lot, in fairness. Like, we started it all up. We got all of these gigs ourselves for the most part. The company that came in got a few, and then we got a few on the run. We were trying to fill as we were going. But there was an unbelievable amount of work put into it, you know?
Yeah.
And and then being away from your families and all that for 5 weeks or 6 weeks on the road. Otherwise, it was really weird coming back here, and it was so tough that when we got back here, I couldn't even talk to anybody. You know what I mean? It was really weird. It took about maybe 2 weeks or something just to actually start to feel normal again. You know.
Yeah, but, even in the States, I know that like you've got all these different time zones and everything. So like if you're starting off over in Vegas where you's boys are, what time are we at? It's 8 o'clock at night here in Scotland. What time is it for you, sir?
It's midday here.
Midday, so 8 hours. So, yeah. But even I know like, so what time would it be on the East Coast?
Right now it's 3:05.
3:05. So I suppose it's not that much of a difference, but still it's enough to kind of, rattle you if you're in and out of them all the time, and even if you're driving
hour,
around.
You drive from here to Havasu, it's an hour's difference. So you lose an hour and gain hours, you know?
Oh, really?
We were going that fast in the RV that we had jet lag when we got to New York.
Jesus, yeah. I suppose that's something I never even thought of. I suppose there must be some parts of the States that there's like literally a line. It's like, here you go, there's 1 o'clock and now it's 2 o'clock.
Oh, yeah.
It changes like that. It does,
Driving to Havasu is like that. You go over the California border and you hit to Havasu. It's like, it's 10:01. Now, you just get there at 10:01 and you go over the line, it's 2:10. Like, what happened?
Havasu is in Arizona. So, but you have to go through California to get to Arizona, whereas Arizona is beside Nevada. Anyway, let's not get into the geography, you know.
James, that's mental. Well, look, boys, for what it's worth, I think that's absolutely amazing that yous have managed to do that. I struggled to get my diary sorted for the year. Never mind for what 2 months time. 2 months? No, what? Not even. What was it, 67? It's mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling that you were able to pull it off with all the logistics of it. But it was mind-boggling that you were actually able to pull it off physically. Like, there before Christmas, I was doing 4 or 5 gigs over a weekend, and I was getting tendonitis in both my hands. I was getting golfer's elbow in my left arm, and I have a bad shoulder from a car crash. So I was getting shooting pains. And like, that was just from teaching guitar a couple of days during the week and then going and doing a few gigs. Just honest to God, you must be superhuman. You must be, because that's absolutely outrageous. It'll give me the fear of the thought of that. No,
we seem to have a certain.
We're stubborn.
We seem to have a certain energy that that a lot of people don't have. As far as the performing comes into play, and and as far as wanting to get the gig done, and we go the extra step. You know what I mean? We seem to anyway. And to be honest with you, it's just like by default for us, whereas other people think or say, you know, and fair play, like that, Jesus, is there played mad? Like, is it doing this, is it doing that, doing the other? But like, we're the kind of people that need to be doing something, you know, otherwise we drive ourselves mad, or our missus is mad, or our family's bleeding mad, you know?
Yeah.
And the other side of that is as well, is that we never look back. We never look back to what we've done, you know? And then sometimes when you're out for a week or 2 weeks and you actually get a time to process what's going on, and then you start to scroll back through Facebook or something, that you kind of go, holy Jesus, did I really do all of that? You know what I mean? So it's a weird one. It's a funny one, you know?
Yeah. No, smashing. Great stuff. As we're saying there earlier on, you have the Irish story part 2, Through a Storm. What's the crack with that, boys?
You kick it out there, Dave.
Basically, it's the second part, and it's all about the 20th anniversary of 9/11, and the Irish involvement in it. And it's basically the stories behind the headlines. And we discovered this as just discovering it, like just be walking through and finding these stories and meeting these people. And it was basically trying to tell from 20 years ago the ripple that was felt around, that just didn't happen in New York. It happened all around the world, and especially the Irish that were involved in it. We lost over 1,000 Irish that day in the towers alone. And then you got the fire department, you got the police department, all the Irish there. The only female cop to be killed that day was Moira Smith, an Irish girl. She went back in 3 times into the towers. These are stories that nobody talks about. They're there, but they're not headlined. So we went, we went and got all these and all these facts, and then basically, very simple was, I was in we all know where we were when the towers went down, and I was actually in my apartment in Temple Bar, watching the news. We had a band meeting because we were with Terry Woods. We were just about to sign a deal. I was actually going through what studio we were going to use and what producer we were going to use and all that. That was the band meeting. And then the second plane hit. And then my mate Sparky said, "That's our record deal gone." I was thinking, "Oh, it's fucking, that's miles away. It's not going to." He was right, because the record industry just stopped, if I even remember it. So fast forward, I'm in Vegas. If that didn't happen, I wouldn't have gone to Vegas. So I was thinking, what happened to the rest of the world? So then they tell you where he was, and then it snowballed from there, from the stories. Coming back to it, on the 19th anniversary, we're standing in Rira, and we said, "Oh, you know what day today is? September 11th. And no one gave a shit, and it really annoyed me. And I said, "What song will we do?" They said, "Let's do You Never Walk Alone." And we did it, and it was like, well, this is powerful, you know what I mean? And not that, and we were. I said, "You coined the phrase 'never forget.' Look like he's all fucking forgot." They didn't. They just didn't want to talk about it. But which I found out through my ignorance. But truly, that's what it was. Because I was there in just a couple of months after the towers went down. I was in New York. I was actually doing a session with a band called Blink, and I went down to the towers. I didn't want to go down, but I said I have to go down. And it killed me. I just seen all the Irish jerseys, all the county jerseys, the names, and it really stuck with me ever since. And then when we went back to the memorial, we were looking at all the Irish names, and we just said, we've got to talk about this. And then the stories we're at the hearing are insane. So that's how that came about.
So the basic premise of it is basically, where were you, you know? Where were you? So we wanted to get, interviews and stories from, first of all, the people that were there. Like, so you have like the likes of firefighters who haven't talked about this for 20 years. And why they want to talk to us? But people are kind of going, how the hell did you get these guys to talk to you? Because they wouldn't talk to anybody. So being Irish, you have that kind of disarming kind of approach, because people seem to have a kind of a soft spot for you here in the States. And because of the Irish link to America, there's actually a great respect for Irish people in this country. So it was kind of like an in for us, although we just wanted to immediately do something to help, and we wanted to be able to bring this to the fore, because it seems to be like fading, and particularly with the young generations coming up, everybody seems to be so desensitized to the whole thing. So a lot of people have been thanking us along with bringing these stories to the fore. So we went and we got prominent artists. I interviewed the likes of Bryan Cranston from Breaking Bad. We got we got Carrot Top. We got Don Felder from the Eagles. We interviewed him here. I mean, there's marvelous interviews that we've gotten. And we've about another five or six prominent ones to get as well. We got Matt Goss from Bross, yeah. We got the Governor Pataki, who was the Governor of New York. We got him, who was the Governor of New York at the time. We got his whole chain of events, his Chief of Police, MTA, Jimmy O'Donnell, and various other heads. We got construction workers. We got really in-depth, very emotional interviews from firefighters. The stories that they're telling you is incredible. So we have all of that. So it's a really, really, really good... it's going to be a great documentary. There's no doubt about that, you know?
It's so outside the box thinking.
Do you know we pitched that the only way we... this is me and him. We're doing this in the car, walking around and saying, like, how's this going to work? And it's the way we want to make documentaries, and the way we feel like making them, and we fell into this, you know, as you know, it was just, look, we love telling stories, but that was it. It's like, you know, you go to a pub in Ireland, and there's always, your brother will go here, it's like, "I have this story for you, and you're not going to believe this." And that's the way I foresee this thing, and that's the way we're doing it. We're walking around, and I said to Dave, "There has to be some humor in this," and he goes like, "We can't, it's 9/11, you know what I mean?" They can't. And then I was thinking, and then only someone else said it. And then we said, it's us discovered and talking to these people. And the way we found ourselves interview. We've done an interview and it was one of the most powerful pieces. The guy talks about if God stood in front of me today, I'd still ask him, I want to be a fireman. And me and him were hanging, like, absolutely, because we'd been out, it was the 20th anniversary. We'd been out with all the firemen until like 6 o'clock in the morning. And we were, and the only reason we were in a nightclub, and I couldn't get into the nightclub because I hadn't got my COVID thing. And the only reason I could get into the nightclub was a guy came behind me playing bagpipes, right in the bouncer's head, and your man says, "Just get the fuck in there. I have to get rid of this lad." That's true. And then we had to go interview the boys the next day, and they grilled us as well to make sure we were the real deal. And we were all emotional at the end of it, and that's where we were. And it's not like and today this happened and that happened. It's like, why am I going to talk to this lad here? And it was all, and that's where we found it more comfortable for us to do it that way and tell the story. Yeah. You know.
So we're linked in with the Tunnels the Towers charity. I'm going to just bring this off my head so you can have a look at this. And this is the charity that all the firefighters are involved in. And what these guys do is they, and you can check it out, t2t.org. They look after all the families and the of all the fallen first responders, and they build houses and pay off mortgages for all the families.
It's amazing of the fallen charity. First responders.
Oh, they're really, really, really good. And we've released the charity single and video as well, which is on our Facebook page at the Black Donnellys. It's at the front. It's pinned to the front of it, so you'll see it straight away.
I'll make sure that's set.
The other thing there is I broke the world record for playing mandolin a couple of weeks ago and gave the I played for 27 and a half hours.
Jeez, there's no stopping you, what?
And then and we gave the money we earned on tips and stuff. We earned $2,000 and we gave that to the Tunnels. We presented them all. They all came in to see us, all the firemen, all the guys that were all there, all on the pile, and they're all mates now, and they're all telling us stuff. So we presented them with the check and the whole business, you know?
That's amazing. That's absolutely fantastic. I've taken a note of that, t2t.org, and I'll make sure that's linked in the description of the podcast
and all your
singles and your videos and all that other stuff. That's fantastic stuff. I love the idea for the documentary. That is, like I said, it's like so outside the box thinking. It's like there's been plenty of documentaries, millions and millions of documentaries about 9/11 and about all these other things. But it's like, it is literally, it's such a niche thing, and it's going to hit home with millions of people. Millions and millions of people around the world. It's hit home with me. Like, I was only, what would I have been, nine? 2001. Yeah, it was only about 8 or 9. I remember it. So that's absolutely amazing. What about this book deal that yous were telling me about then? What's the crack with that then?
I can't believe we're even having this conversation.
Yeah,
you know that.
I know.
I've still got about 3 or 4 points to get through. So if you're still listening at this stage, fair play to you.
Yeah.
Oh, so go on, what about the book deal, boys? What's your book about? Or going to be about, I should say.
It's the journey behind the stories, and it's the journey behind all of this happening, and it's the journey, the stories behind the filming of it and all the rest of it. So it'll go through where I was, where Dave was. That's where we start with that. It'll tell our stories and pretty much how much it has affected us, and then how it affected people connected to us all the way through. So it'll be a story that'll start there. It'll follow our journey, and it'll bring us to the memorial and all the other stuff. And it'll be all the side notes that we miss on the documentary we can actually come in on as well. So it'll encapsulate, one hand will wash the other, you know. So it's going to work synergistically with the documentary. So I think that would be
fantastic.
That's the best way to explain that, you know.
That's amazing. Have you got a title for the book yet?
I love Sprinkler System. Sprinklers. Because there was no sprinklers in the towers.
No sprinkler system in the Twin Towers.
No,
because it was built in the 60s or was it 60s?
70s, yeah. 1972.
72, there you go.
The Jays, though, they had water back in 1972 and fires as well, no?
Yeah.
Well, it's a cheap way of going about saving as you're building, so... there was no sprinkler systems there. And we talked to the guy who's a construction worker, who was working as an electrician at the time. when he was there, yeah. And he knew it was going to come down. So it dispelled all the conspiracy theories as well of the bombs going out. He says he knew that jet fuel burned above 1,200 degrees. He knew that building would not be able to take that, and the steel would burn, and it wilted, and it came down.
He nearly timed it. This thing is going to come down in a second. Get me over there. He watched it from Staten Island. We have his interview.
Unbelievable.
We sat in the house in Staten Island, and the cameras are off, and they said to him, Frank, what do you think of these conspiracy theories? And he just went like, what, the world is flat or something? Is that what you're telling me? You're fucking Santa Claus, yeah. You know what I mean?
He was, he kind of looked at me.
Yeah,
he didn't like what I said, you know, but he knew what I meant. He knew what I was trying to say. He knew I wasn't being like facetious.
You want to be funny about it? Yeah.
No, I wasn't. Not at all. Yeah. But when he talks, everybody listens. Yeah. Everyone in the room.
The minute he said them, you know, I had no sprinkler system, I was like, would you say that on camera? He says, that. I absolutely will. Yeah. Like, I built it, he said.
Mental. Yeah. That's madness. It's like,
we've said that to Americans as well, and they were like, they were as shocked as you were. And apparently I found out only a couple of weeks ago they saved something like 14 million by not putting the sprinkler system in.
And it's all points like that, Barry, that we're going to bring up. Like, well, obviously we don't want to be political about it. Obviously, it's not about that. It's more about just making people aware, and it's more about remembering these absolute heroes that ran in there and gave their lives. And a lot of them knew they weren't coming back out, but they still went in, you know?
So it's
an amazing thing. And the brotherhood, the last thing I'll say about it, the brotherhood of all the firefighters, how they make us feel, and they brought us into their circle and stuff like that. And we're all really good friends now. And so we've been with them now for like a good few times. We met them here in Las Vegas, would you believe? Right around the time. So I believe things are meant to happen. And this is certainly meant to happen. So we know that it's going to come together. We know it's going to happen. So.
I'm very, very much looking forward to that, boys. Yeah, I'll definitely be putting aside me £12.99 for Amazon Prime.
Yeah, it'll be 13. I'm sorry. I'm afraid to say, and I know you live in Scotland, it'll be £13.99 this year.
That's cost of living, lads. Just come on now, for Jez's sake. Yeah. I have to buy the second book as well, I suppose, do I?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Brilliant stuff. No, boys, I'm absolutely buzzing for that. I'm absolutely buzzing for that. That's amazing. And so to promote that, then yous are wanting to get as far and wide all over the world.
Well, the beauty of doing this kind of work, as like Dave has said there, we actually fell into this. Like, you know what I mean? You just don't know what's around the corner, you know. And here we are now making films and editing. Like, we do all the editing, a lot of the editing ourselves here. Like, I've never done that before, and I just fell into it. So the last 2 years, I got into editing and filming and bought a couple of cameras and 6K and 4K and, you know, amazing. How you doing, Kay? And it's just Tommy after K. all, just coming into it. So here we are doing it, like, you know. But the beauty of it is that it's a great thing to be doing. But also, we use it with the music as well, because when we're doing festivals and stuff like that, we can put on the movie as well, and then we can do a Q&A after it. And we did that with the wineries, and we did that with various gigs and theatre gigs that we're doing now. So it's a great way to go and promote it as well. And the bigger the festival, the better, which is why this is why we want to do the festivals as well. On top of that is to get exposed to, let's say, 100,000 people. We do, like, on a weekly basis here, we do about maybe 3,000-4,000 people a week, right?
Yeah.
And we gig 6 nights a week, so, and it is a lot, but, like, you know, but you want to be doing shows where you got 100,000 or 200,000, you know, over the course of a week or whatever. And that way we can promote it. And we want to go and promote part of the deal that we're trying to make with one of the platforms, which is what we have a meeting on Friday about, is to talk about getting a finance package where they will include a portion of that for PR, so that can actually sponsor us to go and tour this as well as we go and do our shows, you know. So that's the idea behind that, you know.
It's like having your own, like, the beauty of being a musician and being a band, because obviously the movies will have soundtracks, is that it doesn't just come out and then it's over. Like, we can tour this for 2 or 3 years, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
the sets will change, we will change, and all stuff will happen around it. But every festival, every gig, we can
promote
it, you know, all the time. But as someone says, you know, stick it out on Facebook and all that. Like, there's over 5 billion people on Facebook. You know what I mean? So there's people everywhere. You know, you see, just
and on top of all of that as well. Sorry, Dave, we're doing a soundtrack as well. So I've written a couple of songs for it as well. We're going to record and we'll have a soundtrack as well and a new album in conjunction with it as well. So, I mean, there's an awful lot of work going on here on the sidelines, you know. And I think because it's taken so long, and I think it's a good, you know, the way COVID has gotten in the way of everything and stopped production all over the place. But I think at the same time, it's given us the impetus to kind of gather as much information as we can and to be able to plan this whole attack. So it's kind of slowly but surely getting there. But it's a big ball to be rolling. There's no doubt about that.
That's massive.
A lot of people are interested in working with us and helping us along and stuff like that. So it looks like it's going to happen. It's just a matter of time. A question of when.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So if there's anyone organizing festivals anywhere in the world listening, get on to the boys. Make sure you get them. So Mr. Glastonbury, give the boys a shout. Who's your man that organized Woodstock? Give him a shout there. Or actually, maybe don't. Have you seen that Netflix?
I've seen that one, yeah.
Maybe don't get on to... Do you know who you should get on to? Your man that organized Fire. Remember that one?
Wasn't that brilliant? That would have been me. That definitely would have been me. I would have easily done that. Well, I got phone calls from my mates going, say, Dave, have you seen that thing? That's definitely would have been you doing that. Come over,
sure
it's great. You got four stars.
That's
great. The tents got me, man. The tents was the best.
I thought that was hilarious. And the little the shitey little sandwiches with like the one brilliant. Easy single as gas. But I tell you what, if you got involved with something like that, where as much as it didn't happen, people would never fucking forget you anyway.
They'd never forget you.
Yeah, but you'd never work again either.
But you'd never work again either. But then you'd probably get another film deal on how shy it was. So like, do you know what I mean? Things around about. There's a market for absolutely everything. Excellent stuff. So, well, boys, that's been unbelievable. We're at an hour and 10 minutes, and I cannot believe it's at an hour and 10 minutes. It's the quickest hour and 10 minutes I've ever had in my entire life. Usually now I'd say, well, what are you working on next? But Jesus Christ, I don't think we have another an hour and 10 minutes. what we'll do is, how's about we just we'll finish off now with a quick fire round of just some mental stupid questions, just to see, like, people have gotten to know you over the past hour, know kind of what makes you tick in, like, your working life, your working sense. But these are just stupid films, just to see what makes Dave Brown and Dave Rooney tick. So what we'll do is, Dave, we've got 10 questions ish. Dave Brown, we'll start with you. What's your favorite film?
Goodfellas.
Dave Rooney.
Once Upon a Time in America.
Oh, boys. Great. Great taste. Dave Rooney, what is the... we've already asked you what the favorite instrument that you own is. What's your favorite word?
Serendipitous.
Fantastic. Dave Brown, say favorite word.
Bollocks.
Like Colin Meaney. Yeah, bollock. Great stuff. Dave Brown, tea or coffee?
Coffee. Unless I have chocolate biscuits, then it's tea.
See, this is the thing. I've got a mate and he's from Derry. His family would be from Londonderry. But he's from Derry and his mate. He's real sound. He lives in Australia now. But his ma said to me one time, he says, you can never get a fucking straight answer out of someone from the Republic. It's always like, and that's just proving the point. It's like, tea or coffee? Well, coffee, unless you've got Bickies.
Yeah, unless you've got chocolate hobnobs, then it has to be fucking tea, man. Do you know what I mean?
It has to be tea, yeah. Unless it's a Wednesday afternoon and it's kind of half raining outside. Then in that case, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but anyway, points.
Very fair points. Dave Rooney, tea or coffee?
Tea.
Tea, good man, unless...
Tea.
Right, grand. Dave Rooney, if you could have an unlimited amount of anything, what would it be?
Money.
That's the correct answer. The last lad I had on the podcast said Guinness. And then it was only after he was like, oh, fuck, no, hang on, money. He was like, I can buy you Guinness afterwards. Dave Brown, unlimited amount of anything.
Pubs.
Good man yourself. Good man yourself. And we'll do two more. What do you regret spending money on? Dave Brown, we'll go for.
What's
one thing that you probably you thought, right, this is going to be worth it, but it was the greatest waste of fucking time you ever bought?
Oh man, I spent a load of money on a festival in 1999 and lost me bollocks on it. Yeah. Yeah, Cross Village Festival. Yeah, check that out. Yeah, man. Yeah, lost me bollocks on it. Cross Village.
Good stuff. Oh, you did.
Yeah,
I thought that was a joke. Cross Village Festival.
Yeah, that was me. Me and two other guys. We lost it. Still paying for it. Yeah.
Oh, still looking for us.
Oh, there's I'm sure there's another episode's worth
I already talked to the boys about that. Yeah.
Oh Jesus! Right, we'll have to look that up. Dave Rooney, what was what do you regret spending money on?
A 12 string Golden Leaf guitar, which was absolute shite. I mean, you can't even tune it. You can't. I got it and I bet it around the garage out there. It's out there half dead in the garage. Yeah. I came home drunk one night and I danced on it.
Oh, Jesus. Right, fair enough. Last question to the Perry. Dave Rooney, first of all, now, this is the million, as you'd say, the million-dollar question. What would you be doing if you weren't a musician?
If I wasn't a musician, probably be a pilot.
Oh, a pilot?
Yeah.
Choppers, had an interest. Planes?
Planes, just, you know, commercial planes and stuff like that. It was one of the things that I was going to do, and I was living in Denmark. SAS, Scandinavian Airstream, were taking applications at the time. And then Danske Bank would lend you the 40 grand for the education and stuff like that. And the same week I got accepted into the Music Conservatorium of Copenhagen. And the same week I moved to Santa Ponsa to play Basho Paddy Wackery songs with Eamon Mitchell.
Jesus.
Yeah, imagine. There you go. Yeah.
How different things could have been, huh?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, look, I'm a firm believer in it. Is you are where you're meant to be, you know, and what's for you won't pass you and all that stuff. And
as your granny says, yeah.
As you're pushed in various directions, there's loads of doors that you can take, but there is a gravitational pull to where you're supposed to be. And generally, you go in that direction. And if you don't go in that direction, life is a funny way of giving you a kick up the hole and sending you back down the other corridor. You know what I mean? So
it does.
It's just so that's how I see it. So. I was always going to be a musician. Always, yeah, definitely.
I agree with you. I was exactly the same. No matter what job I tried to get stuck into, and I really did my best. I worked so hard on myself as a person to try and force myself into this role that I just wasn't meant to be. Just when it came down to it, if it wasn't music, I just physically couldn't make myself do it. I just wouldn't work.
Exactly.
Browner, what would you be doing if you weren't a musician?
I definitely in some sort of fucking Del Boy job, you know. I'd be promoting the doing. I'd be putting on gigs, or I'd be in definitely in the industry of doing something like that.
Jimmy Rabbit.
I'd be browder than some fucker somewhere. Do you know what I mean?
Sure enough. Right. Well, listen, boys. This is a conversation I will never ever forget. Thank you very very much. That's been fantastic stuff. Check out the Black Colonies. When am I getting back over? I don't know. I'd love to do it again. I've got a baby now. I've got a business here. And I've got all the gigs that I want. So it's not as simple as it was when I was 21. But I'd love to. I'd love to get back over. Myself and my bandmate, we were... when would it have been? Before COVID and kind of in the middle of COVID. We were kind of half working on an Irish music show, and we were kind of writing out, like, it was going to be called The Story of Crack. And the idea is still there. We may or we may not do it, but sure, look, you never say
give
never.
Give it a go.
Yeah, I will. We definitely will. Boys, we'll sign off there. Thank you very, very much. That's been an absolute pleasure.
That was great
fun.
Yeah, great to talk to you, buddy.
That was The Music Career Show. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and tell your friends about The Music Career Show.